All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is on with me, and I'm always happy when he's here. You know, Sandy, I wanted to switch gears again. And Ukrainian MP has warned of an impending famine if action is not taken to unblock the country's ports and release millions of tons of tonners of grain. PA Media reports Kara Rudick, leader of the Liberal Voice Party, was speaking to journalists at the Scottish Parliament. Before the war, Ukraine was top three of the countries producing grains, wheat, sunflower oil, tomatoes, and corn, Rudick said. Exports that could feed the rest of the world, the MP said, were stuck in ports in Ukraine with no way of getting them out. In 10 weeks, we are facing famine, especially for countries in the global south. We need a unified approach to help unblock our ports and help get all this harvest out. Rudick says she raised the issue in a meeting with Westminster Conservative MP Tobias Elwood. And so we're coming up, Sandy, to a critical point in this war early. Russia definitely is not going to allow that grain and wheat to get out. They're using that as leverage to maybe make Ukraine and the nation do what they want them to do in order to release that all of that bounty. What is your take on it?
Well, I think there is negotiation going on with Russia as to whether they'll open up Odessa or one of the ports and allow it to be the portal through which grain would move. But one of the horrors of war is the extent to which it dislocates what goes on in the world, and the world is far more interdependent. It isn't just silicone chips and parts for cars that are interdependent. You know, Egypt and Northern Africa gets all of its grain from Russia and Ukraine and that area, or not all of it, but a substantial right. percentage of it. And so we've got all these situations that are interdependent, and when the machinery breaks down, and clearly warfare destroys the machinery of normal commerce in the region in which it's occurring. So one of the things that ought to be taken into account by those who might participate either directly or indirectly in the initiation of warfare or the conditions that start warfare is the extent to which it's going to disrupt not just the participants in the war, but the whole region, and particularly in countries that are sources. I mean, Afghanistan might not have been the source of a great deal of stuff for the world other than maybe poppies, which are probably used for more nefarious purposes. But, the warfare disrupts the world, and we knew that. We saw that in World War II. The whole world was put on in a complete state of chaos as a result of a large war.
You know, Sandy,
and that's what we can expect.
Well, you know, and maybe because World War II was so long ago that there aren't a lot of people still around who remember it. But the outcomes of it. But we're here now, and this is upon us. And what Russia is going to want in return, Ukraine is not going to like.
Well, yes, and that's the problem with the current process. It's not clear the extent to which negotiation is ongoing, but I continue to say that the outcome of this war is a pretty clear in terms of what the likely outcome is, and it's the same outcome that was likely at the time that Ukraine was surrounded by Russian troops, and it has to do with Ukraine giving up claims for Crimea and the settlement of the issues associated with the Donbas region. And I think no matter how long this war goes on, that's going to be the ultimate outcome of it. In the meantime, there's been a great deal of suffering to get from here to there, and that's the thing that we ought to analyze you know, day after tomorrow, is what was the cause of the precipitating events. And I think part of it was that Ukraine's unwillingness to get to that point of negotiation without war. And if they get to that point after war, then I think we can see that maybe the participants, the people who helped Ukraine resist that negotiation, were maybe not doing a wise thing.
You know, Sandy, I'm looking at this. Zelensky is saying that Ukraine is losing 100 soldiers every day, 500 wounded every day. And yet the outcome of it, of what's going to occur, as you just stated, it's we already know what the outcome is going to be. No matter how long it takes, we know what the outcome is going to be. It's David taking on Goliath. Taking on David, taking on Goliath, we know what the outcome is going to be. There is no scenario that Ukraine wins this, right?
Right. I mean, we're not going to be able to find the magic stone that David can put in a slingshot and take down Goliath. We're gonna prolong the fight. David's going to sustain a lot of blows. It's going to last a lot longer than people expected. You know, we're giving Ukraine these rockets now. And these rockets are designed to be more sophisticated, more capable of defending Ukraine. They have the potential to be used offensively and to be fired into Russia, which is creating sort of a tinderbox of issues associated with our delicate balance of supporting Ukraine without provoking Russia by giving Ukraine offensive weapons instead of defensive weapons. And so, you know, the U.S. is sort of treading on this dangerous water, but we're being very careful now to restrict Ukraine with respect to the use of those rockets so they can only be used defensively. And it's clear that if Ukraine is constrained only to the defensive use of weapons to defend against this war with the much larger opponent, ultimately the outcome is predictable.
Yeah, let's do this. Let's go to the phone lines. CJ, what's going on?
Thank you for taking my call, Earl and Sandy. Let's not forget how we got here. We're not safe with a Democrat president.
Oh.
Obama watched the red line drawn in Syria and did nothing, and then watched Russia walk through Crimea. So that's on the Black Sea, and this is on Biden. This all, remember his sanctions were meant to deter. Oh, yeah. His administration said that. And then he said, no, they were never meant to deter. This is a failure in Afghanistan. We left famine and allies behind in Afghanistan. And you guys will excuse the 13 soldiers lost. And I cried over that Memorial Day, and I hope
you did.
Other Americans.
So you cried over the 13 soldiers that died in Afghanistan. You know why? Soldiers are dying. Soldiers are dying. Soldiers are dying all over the world. You know. Why did you pick Afghanistan soldiers to die over? Or are you, this a political?
I cried over them all.
Yeah, but you said Afghanistan.
You want to excuse Joe Biden? He caused this. This is his war. He watched Afghanistan. He failed it. He surrendered it. He gave up. And Putin saw weakness. We see it today. We're going to see it in Taiwan. And you're going to excuse a nuclear war. We have Iran, who has enough power or centrifuges to build a nuclear weapon.
And so Iran is going to now enter the nuclear age, and we're going to be fearful of the prehistoric nuclear weapon that Iran is going to have, even though we have the second most nuclear weapons and the most updated nuclear arsenal in the world. Is that what you're telling me?
We're going to watch them. They promised to use it on Israel, Earl. You may excuse it, but this is a failure.
Do you think Israel is not capable of defending themselves with their updated nuclear weapons? Do you think that?
Yeah. Well, you may. This is walked. Remember, these sanctions were meant to deter.
Hey, hold on, hold on, hold on, Sandy, do you care to respond?
It's a joke.
Well, I think CJ forgets that Pakistan and some countries that are pretty fragile have nuclear weapons as well, and so the proliferation of, and North Korea has nuclear weapons or appears to,
because of Bill Clinton, and Madeleine Albright.
CJ, really, come on. How about the Iraq War and the, how sound was that Iraq War, and was that a democratic war?
No, but no. You know what? Peace through strength. And was Saddam Hussein, did he follow the sanctions and the beliefs of the UN as they watched them walk into where? You know, Saddam was able, he was never forthcoming with evidence. And how many?
He was our ally. He was our ally, right?
Yeah, he sure was.
Okay.
What a joke.
We armed him during the Reagan administration. We actually armed Iraq
when he went to war with Iran.
When he went to war with Iran. So I just think things are, CJ, let me just say, I think things are a lot more complicated than you would like to assume they are.
Oh, certainly.
I think that the assumptions you make are quite biased in the way you want to look at the world, and I think if you persist in unbundling facts in the way you do, I hope that there aren't a lot of people following your path. That's all.
Sandy, we got to go to the break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Be right back. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. Sandy Williams is on the line. And before we go to the phone lines, you know, Sandy, before we and during the break, we were talking about how history is going to see this battle. And people are going to celebrate and say, look at Ukraine stood up to this beast, and they've done some great things, and we celebrate Ukraine.
I'm not sure that's how history will look at it. I think that's how it's being looked at right now.
Right.
Because during this process of the fight, it's like I suppose a mixed martial art contest that goes on for quite a while, and people are remark about what a great fight it is. But you know, when David fights Goliath and David doesn't win. And that's really the altogether probable outcome here. In fact, sometimes people from the U.S. State Department utter what I think is maybe the policy that we're pursuing right now, which is we're gonna help this war. We're gonna help Ukraine resist Russia to the point that Russia exhausts its resources, so it's not capable of doing this in another place. But that doesn't mean that it won't accomplish it in this place. And if it does accomplish what it was trying to negotiate for before the war began, then what will happen is the outcome for Ukraine will be the same as if the war didn't occur in terms of the outcome. But in the meantime, Ukraine will have suffered a terrible tragedy. And I think history will look at this as a terrible tragedy for Ukraine.
All right, let's go to the phone line. Sam, who do we have up first?
Gary from Sussex is on the line.
Hey, Gary, what's going on? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Well, I want to say hi to both you guys. I love listening to Sandy. And so I'm excited that we get a chance to talk to him. I got one question for you, Earl, and Sandy, you can answer it too. Why has the Milwaukee Common Council want to charge the Republicans $6 million to have the convention in Milwaukee when it's going to help the people in Milwaukee and the businesses in Milwaukee? And then they didn't want to charge the Democrats a couple of years ago when they were going to have the convention there.
First off, Gary, it's off topic. And,
I'll go back on topic. But
Sandy, you want to respond?
Well, I think it's being debated, and I'm not sure that the leadership is taking the position of wanting to charge for it. My perception reading the news is that it's not a decision. It's a discussion right now. And so I don't have much to say about it. You know, I think that
okay.
they have to weigh the pros and cons.
Well, I had on Dr. Michael Rosen week before last or last week, and he was able to prove that none of these conventions ever wind up, making money for the host cities. And he had documentation to back that up. So that is part of the reason. He wrote an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
But two years ago for the Democrats, it was going to make money. But now all of a sudden, it's not going to make money.
Well, Dr. Rosen again, said it doesn't matter where it is, it doesn't make money for the city. But go ahead.
All right, back on topic about Ukraine. The last thing you guys are talking about, I want to make a comment to Sandy. Do you believe that Russia would have attacked Ukraine if they would have been part of NATO?
Well, no, but they weren't going to become part of NATO because it was pretty clear from all the intelligence that Germany and some other of the NATO countries weren't going to allow Ukraine to join NATO. The United States was flirting with Ukraine, talking about the possibility of joining NATO, just as back in the first decade of the 2000s, they talked to Russia about joining NATO. And would they have invaded? Probably not. But would they have invaded Ukraine if we had not armed Ukraine and given them the wherewithal to resist negotiating with Russia in the same manner that, for instance, Georgia negotiated with Russia over the relationship with Russia?
Well, I understand that. Go ahead, Sandy.
Well,
I'm not CJ here. I don't talk over you guys.
I'm sorry. Well, I didn't mean to talk over you either. Georgia and Ukraine were in more or less the same position in terms of being separate entities, separate ethnicities, and we did not decide to arm or create the wherewithal for Georgia to resist its negotiations with Russia back in the first decade of the 2000s when Georgia elected a Western-leaning president and Russia exerted some influence at that point to keep Georgia from embracing the European Union and NATO in a manner that was uncomfortable to Russia. And Georgia is prospering. Georgia has entered into arrangements which creates a very tight relationship with Russia. But Georgia is processing in the meantime. And so we aren't troubled by the situation in Georgia. And we might not well have been troubled with the situation in Ukraine, but we decided affirmatively to give Ukraine the wherewithal to resist Russia and its negotiations back in 2010. And ever since 2010, there have been troubles that have sort of dragged us into the fray to increasing levels.
Well, the thing is, Putin made Zelensky promise that he would never join NATO. And to me, if we're going to be sending $40 billion over there, plus a lot of military aid and everything else, to me, I don't know if I was president of the United States, whether you're Democrat or Republican, to get ourselves mixed up in something like this if they weren't willing to join NATO. You know, that's my opinion. And I think
you're in absolute agreement. You're in absolute agreement with me. You see, we don't really have the geopolitical appetite, and Ukraine is not critically important enough to us for us to want to send troops and put boots on the ground in Ukraine, right? And you're saying the very same thing. And because we aren't willing to put boots on the ground, we shouldn't have Ukraine in NATO, because if Ukraine was in NATO, we would have to have boots on the ground now.
Exactly. But I don't believe if Ukraine was part of NATO, I don't believe the Russians would attack. They wouldn't.
Well,
they would never attack a NATO country because they would have the entire world after them, you know, And you can't beat everybody.
But the reason why Germany wasn't
thank you, Gary. Thank you for the call. Go ahead, Sandy.
The reason Germany didn't want Ukraine in NATO was the very fact that Ukraine does have some very strategic importance to Russia, and there was a potential risk that Russia would risk it all. They've come close to risking it all on this invasion of Ukraine. And the Crimea, and particularly Sevastopol, is very critically important to Russia. And so, you know, I think we like to minimize in our mind the notion that Russia would have strategic interests in a part of Ukraine. But Sevastopol was part of Russia and part of the Russian Empire since the 1800s, and is the most critical southern port for naval vessels that Russia has. And it's in Crimea, which was part of Ukraine.
All right, we've got to go to a break. On the line, Sandy Williams. You two can join us, 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. Sandy Williams is here on, and you can also text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, while the Ukraine mess continues to move forward, I was reading this article this morning in Newsweek, and it was will China invade Taiwan? You know, I guess it's more than a thought. You don't even want to even begin to think about it. But I know the other day there was concern about, you know, China flying some jets in the airspace of Taiwan. But this is what this article had to say. Joe Biden caused something of an international incident recently when he publicly committed to the defense of Taiwan, the island democracy off the coast of China that Beijing has vowed to unify with the mainland, if necessary, by force. Buried behind the headlines of the president's seemingly unequivocal pledge in Tokyo on May 23rd was his assessment that a Chinese invasion of the smaller neighbor will not happen and will not be attempted. But this scenario, Biden says, would be contingent upon the world's ability to convince Beijing of potential long-term disapprobation should it attack Taiwan. Sandy, why are we even talking about that?
Well, because we've for decades, ever since 1950, allowed ourselves and the rest of the world to have a very complicated public and private diplomatic policy associated with the island that was Taipei, that then was Formosa. You know, when we were growing up, everyone knew it as Formosa. Now it's Taiwan. And the fact is that island is not recognized by the United States as a country. And we are very careful to indicate to the world and to China that we have a one China policy, one China meaning that Taiwan is a part of China. So while we allow the press and maybe the president to talk sort of generically about how Taiwan is a democracy, Taiwan is actually, as far as we're concerned, diplomatically, part of the sovereign territory of China. And the question really is, what kind of a relationship does China have with its territory, Taiwan? Similar to the world's view of what kind of a relationship did China have with its territory, Hong Kong. because at the end of the term of the English lease of the Hong Kong territory, they had something like a lease of an apartment. They had a lease of this of the nation of Hong Kong, or the geography of Hong Kong. At the end of that lease, it reverted to China. It was Chinese territory and up to China for how they would treat it. And while we all stood aghast and were upset with the fact that China was going to assert control over Hong Kong, that's what it's done.
So is this...
And that's what it could do over Taiwan. We've armed Taiwan to the teeth, much the way we armed Ukraine to the teeth, in a way that allows Taiwan to potentially assert itself against China, and to try and assert its independence from China. But when push comes to shove, and when the people in the State Department are asked about what Joe Biden said, they always correct it and say, no, we haven't changed our policy. We still have a one China policy. We still have what we call strategic ambiguity about our policy towards China. So all this sword rattling is, I guess, designed to make sure that China does not do something that is offensive to the world about the way they assert their sovereignty over Taiwan.
You know, Sandy, you said offensive to the world. We know that when they say offensive to the world, we mean offensive to the United States. And China knows that, you know, that behind all of this, again, is our bombast that we continue. When do we grow past this, Sandy? That may have worked on China 40 years ago, 100 years ago. It certainly doesn't scare them today.
No. And in fact, I had a conversation with a friend who is part of the intelligence apparatus of the United States for an entire career. And that the conversation was about this vision of hegemony, this notion that there is a geopolitical sphere of influence for large powers. And clearly the United States believe we have hegemony. Heck, since 1990, we've asserted our hegemony over the world. I mean, we're basically asserting hegemony over Ukraine by reaching there, sending them weapons, getting all involved in the negotiation and the situation they have with their geopolitical neighbor, Russia. And yet we're denying Russia its hegemony over what is clearly a part of its geopolitical sphere of influence, which is Ukraine. And so this is a very dangerous kind of foreign policy that we've adopted, because clearly there are certainly two, and based on armaments, three major powers in the world: Russia, China, and the United States. And if we are the only nation that's allowed to assert its hegemony, and we don't allow those other two to have their geopolitical realities, we're putting ourselves in a very dicey position, because geopolitical reality is meant to respect and to reflect realities. And the reality is that we aren't going to send troops to a place like Ukraine because it's not geopolitically important enough to us. Similarly, Taiwan is geopolitically a part of China, and it's really not geopolitically, other than the fact that they make lots of silicone chips, which, incidentally, the ones that aren't made there are made in Shanghai. So, I'm not sure what we're arguing about here.
You know, Sandy, if at some point in time, if the American people don't go outside of what we are normally learning about the world, or if we're relying on others to educate us about what is happening in the world, and not finding out on our own and not looking to find out exactly what is taking place, it's a recipe for long-term for disaster, Sandy. The American people still believe that we're the kings, we're the king makers, and everybody's going to dance to the beat of our drums. That stuff that's no longer going to fly. And so the American people think that we're superior in all aspects, and you know that we're not. But at some point in time, we've got to come to that realization, Sandy, or it's not going to get any better for us.
Well, if we don't come to that realization, the size of our military budget is going to become so oversized. I mean, the result of Ukraine and then the discussion of Taiwan has led American political figures to talk about having a military annual budget that's in excess of $1 trillion. And that's exhausting on the American economy. It's exhausting on our social stability, because the fact that we spend that kind of money is rendering us and creating the problem for Tom, Dick, and Mary that I was describing in the first hour of the show, which is we can't tolerate the business cycle because Tom, Dick, and Mary don't have government support and a social apparatus to support them like exists in Europe. We don't have child daycare. We don't have health care. So when someone in the United States gets laid off, they fall into a desperate situation. And that's not the case in Europe. And it's not the case in Europe when prices rise that people suddenly can't afford the necessities of life because they have a safety net that supports them. And if we had that safety net in the United States, we'd be having a whole different discussion today about what's going on.
But Sandy, we've got the American people, a segment of the American people who don't believe in safety nets. They believe it's a handout. And
They don't believe in social safety nets, but they believe in this Pax Americana principle of American exceptionalism that has us running around the world, putting ourselves in the position of being in very fraught military problems and situations, and therefore spending a huge amount of money on our military budget. So, And yet, you know, for instance, we talk about the democracy in Taiwan. I'd be interested in just how democratic Taiwan is, because many of the countries that we are allied with are not democracies. That's for sure. In fact, we're sending emissaries right now to Saudi Arabia to try and patch up our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the mirror image of a democracy. There is nothing democratic about what goes on in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but they've got the oil.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. And yeah. So, you know, Sandy, you look at these things and you say, well, if the American people really, enough of us, I shouldn't say that there aren't any, but there certainly does not appear to be enough of us who see long-term this is unsustainable. It's unsustainable. It may not happen in your or my lifetime, but it is unsustainable. And
yes, I mean,
go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's unsustainable in a way that actually puts at risk. We talk about our military being sent out to save America and to make America safe and free. And yet this expenditure of money without regard to taking care of Tom, Dick, and Mary in our country is actually putting America at risk, serious risk, because of the social consequences in America of not having in place the things that are needed to protect its people and to provide welfare to its people creates a much greater risk than could ever exist from a Chinese exercise of sovereignty over Taiwan.
You know, it is... on the one hand, it feels good to say, well, you know, we just had Memorial Day and people celebrate and they talk about the lives that were sacrificed, Sandy, to make the nation what it is. And we're proud of all of those things. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be proud of all those things, but all of those lives were lost, Sandy. And you got to ask the questions. In some instances, they were lost unnecessarily, and nobody pushed back on it. It's what you talk about, the fact that at some point in time, we've got to be willing to push back on things, or there'll always be more martyrs that we'll be celebrating on Memorial Day. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, Texas, that same number. Sandy Williams is on the line, and I'm glad he is. You know, Sandy, I don't know how many times or how differently you can say it, but internally in our nation, it's where the real threat is. And anybody who doesn't seem to understand that, if you think that the only way to solve that threat is the same way you look internationally and you want us to be strong militarily, it's just like you want people want us to be strong with law enforcement. And it's the same mentality, you know, strength through, you know, force. And that doesn't always work. That's not always the best solution. And anybody who pushes back against that somehow is anti-American. But we've got to come to the point where these discussions that you've been talking about for a long time, Sandy, and I, there are times that I'm out and people say, well, you're anti-American, you and Sandy, you're always talking about our country. And I'm saying, what do you mean talking about our country? Isn't that what is supposed to separate our nation from other nations, Sandy, that we can have the open dialogue about things? Well, why should we be, you know, neutered when clearly what's based on what our economy, our Constitution says, we have the right to have these conversations? Why wouldn't we?
Well, I mean, two things. One, of course, we have the right to have the conversation, and that's one of the reasons that you and I love this country,
right?
Because, you know, it permits us to.
Right.
But the point of the conversation is to improve America. It's to make it better. It's because of our love of country that we want it to be the place that that it could be, and not the place that it might actually be, because it's flawed. You and I are flawed. Everybody, every human being is flawed, and every country has flaws, and we have flaws. If we as a country are unwilling to recognize that we have any flaws, then, you know, the notion that most of us learn in religion, that humans are flawed and that we're all on a quest to be better and to serve one another better, I don't understand. I don't understand the instinct that Americans have, this notion of exceptionalism that requires that we think of every element of our society as being perfect.
Yeah, it's certainly not that. When you can't start with the fact that inside of your own nation, that people struggle, and you say, well, it's because people are struggling. They live in this country and they're struggling because they're failures and they're just not working hard enough. But if you look then again and say, as you have been pointing out, Sandy, about where we are and that our business cycle is changing, the people don't know that the business cycle is changing. The people aren't aware that when a business cycle changes, in many instances, we don't even know the process of the business cycle. But we're at the whim of that business cycle. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, the business people do know that there are business cycles. Every business plans for the cycle and tries to have contingency plans and arrangements for their financing that will accommodate the business cycle. And everyone understands the impact of the business cycle on the people. And why have we not built a society and a socioeconomic system and a political system that will help the people work through and survive in the business cycle? In the 1970s, people survived business cycles far better because their health care that they received from, for instance, you from A.O. Smith, right, didn't lapse when you were laid off.
That's correct. That's correct.
So you didn't suffer the disaster of a loss of health care because you were laid off in a system in which it continued. And in today's world, that isn't the case when people, because most people don't get laid off. They simply get released.
Right.
And they get released into a circumstance where there is no health care, or they are already employed in a circumstance in which they must buy their own health care, so that when they get laid off, They don't have the money to pay for their health care, and they don't have the money to pay for daycare.
You know, Sandy, I don't know if it was so much that the business community was so benevolent as it was that there was a union that negotiated and on behalf, an organized effort of people who could push back against the corporations and say, look, this is what we need. That's missing today.
Yes. I mean, yes, it is missing. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, what Karl Marx predicted, which was that labor would be exploited by the owners of businesses, has to some extent occurred, maybe inadvertently, but many business models have become built on the notion that they will use part-time laborers to avoid the payment of benefits. You know, they lots of businesses hire people and tell them you're never going to work more than 36 hours a week, and we're going to enforce that because we want to make sure we don't have to pay you benefits. And many of those people are working at minimum wage jobs or not much above minimum wage. And so the clear implication of that is we're going to employ you, but incidentally, you won't be able to afford health care, and we're not going to give you health care, and you're not going to be able to afford child daycare. So you better have figured that one out.
You know,
there is no figuring that out.
You know, Sandy, there's also businesses that will let somebody go before they're able to claim unemployment. They haven't worked enough weeks to even get unemployment. I mean, I've seen some situations that are heartbreaking. You know, so when they're laid off, that's it. They didn't get enough weeks in. They're a week or two short. And so you got to talk about that, right? I mean, you can't just continue to say, well, the business is right. And so the business protects itself, but to hell with the citizens, with the people who make up the country. But that's where we are. And there are not a lot of, you know, shows, to be honest, that talk like you and I. And not even on the national level, Sandy. You know, you and I listen to others. And there's not a lot of these kinds of dialogues going on because for whatever reason, and this is to the credit of the owner of this radio station, he gives us the freedom and latitude to have these kinds of discussions that you won't get many other places.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think and maybe we'll talk about it the next hour, but I think that with this confluence of circumstances right now, a war in Ukraine draining our resources in the direction of expenditures on the military at the same time as we have inflation and a probable recession might wake our political process up to the process of realizing that, number one, our military expenditures make it very difficult for us to solve social problems in our country. And two, we have social problems in this country that need to be solved. And if they were solved, we could work our way through business cycles in a better way. So, you know, maybe the lemonade out of this could be a political awareness that we need to create a safety net system, a viable safety net system in our country to support a vibrant economy.
All right, Sandy, and listen, audience, I got to run. I'm going to a graduation. Sandy's going to take it in from here. Sandy, have you done any solo flying yet?
On this show?
Yeah, I'm only joking.
Yeah, I'm going to be that pilot. I'm going to be that pilot. I'm going to call ground control and say, yeah, I've never landed one of these.
Right. I'll see you guys on Friday. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sandy will take it from here. Be right back.